Baldwin was an openly gay black man, whose second novel, Giovanni's Room, published in 1956, was a love story between two white men.
In 1985, a butch hairdresser named Jim Hutton headed out to a gay club in London called Heaven. And that's what he found. His name was Freddie Mercury.
John and Theo came up with Oscar. It was not me. I jumped on the wagon, you know, as soon as I heard.
You did. Was it an immediate reaction?
Oh, absolutely.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queen Elizabeth crowns marriage equality, Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son get a timely reissue, and an out-counter tenor sings the praises of Oscar. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 20th, 2013. Britain's Queen Elizabeth gave her royal assent on July 17th to legislation that has brought marriage equality to England and Wales. The Marriage Same-Sex Couples Bill passed its third reading in the House of Commons on May 21st and its third reading in the House of Lords on July 15th. Strong support by Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron was said to have been key to the bill's passage in both chambers by comfortable margins. In a speech to his own party in 2011, Cameron famously said that Conservatives believe in the ties that bind us, that society's stronger when we make vows to each other and we support each other. So I don't support gay marriage in spite of being a conservative. I support gay marriage because I am a conservative. The new law also allows same-gender couples to convert their civil partnerships, heretofore their only option, to marriages. The bill did have its conservative opponents both in Parliament and from the pulpit, even though the legislation includes strong guarantees that religious institutions won't be forced to perform marriage ceremonies for same-gender couples. It will still take some time for the government to resolve several specific questions arising from marriage equality that involve other UK laws, such as those covering taxation, pensions, and inheritance. According to most political prophets, the first civil marriages of lesbian and gay couples in England and Wales will take place in the summer of 2014. Counted separately, they become the 16th and 17th countries in the world to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Marriage equality legislation has already been presented in the Scottish Parliament. Debate there is expected to start in October or November. A referendum on the question is scheduled for next year in Ireland.
Elsewhere, U.S. Republican representatives did a bit of house cleaning this week. After spending more than $3 million taxpayer dollars defending the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, a lawyer for the chamber's inaccurately named Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, or BLAG, announced that it will stop defending the law in several ongoing federal court challenges. There's been heavy criticism of the distinctly partisan Republican effort to defend DOMA and similar statutes in various federal court cases around the country. BuzzFeed's Chris Geidner reported that BLAG's lawyer told him this week, in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in Windsor, which overturned the DOMA provision that banned federal recognition of legally married same-gender couples, that the House now seeks leave to withdraw as a party defendant.
In news from Down Under, Tourism New Zealand is flying an Australian gay couple and eight friends and family members to Wellington for what the agency calls a dream wedding. It's scheduled for August 19th, the first day that the new law opening civil marriage to same-gender couples in New Zealand takes effect. Tourism New Zealand hopes the publicity will lure more Australian gay and lesbian couples across the Tasman Sea to legally wed, something they can't yet do in their own country.
Not to be outdone, Air New Zealand is planning to host the first same-gender wedding of a Kiwi couple at 30,000 feet, no less, on the same day. The ceremony for this particular couple, also chosen from an online competition, will be held during a flight from Queenstown to Auckland. The airline announced this week that Jesse Tyler Ferguson, the out star of the hit TV sitcom Modern Family, will be on board with his partner Justin Makita to witness the proceedings. Ferguson and Makita reportedly plan to themselves marry in New York sometime soon.
But Alastair Stewart of Britain's Kaleidoscope Trust, which promotes LGBT rights internationally, told the Huffington Post UK this week that advances such as marriage equality in the West have led to a perverse worsening of LGBT freedoms in the developing world. The battles for LGBT people there are about the most fundamental of human rights, he said. 76 countries continue to criminalize homosexual conduct, punishable with prison sentences and hard labor. In 5 countries, the death penalty still applies. Stewart said that Western opponents of LGBT rights have increasingly been moving their resources to the developing world. American evangelical churches are abandoning the fight against equality at home in favor of supporting homophobic laws abroad, he said. Why fight a losing battle against social liberalism in America or Europe, where you are increasingly ignored and ridiculed, when in Uganda, Belize, or Nigeria, you are welcomed with open arms?
In the latest tragic news from that part of the world, a prominent LGBT and AIDS activist in the West Central African nation of Cameroon, Eric Lembembe, was horrifically tortured to death earlier this month. Police officials in Yaoundé said that his feet and neck were broken, and his face, hands, and feet had been badly burned with an iron. Lembembe was killed 2 weeks after he issued a public warning about the threat posed by what he called anti-gay thugs. The Yaoundé office of the LGBT advocacy group Alternatives Cameroon was set on fire on June 26th. Lembembe's friends say that the authorities have yet to launch an investigation into his brutal murder. "We don't know who killed Eric Lembembe, or why he was killed," a statement by Human Rights Watch said. "But one thing is clear. The Cameroonian authorities' utter failure to stem homophobic violence sends the message that these attacks can be carried out with impunity." The U.S. government and the United Nations have been among those issuing official statements condemning the killing and demanding the arrests and convictions of those responsible. Private consensual adult same-gender sex is punishable in Cameroon by flogging and up to 5 years behind bars. That's not as harsh as some other countries on the continent, but Cameroon is often described as the worst place on earth to be LGBT because, according to Gay Star News, more people are criminally prosecuted for their sexual orientation or gender identity there than anywhere else in the world.
On the Arabian Peninsula, 2 members of a Yemeni Al-Qaeda-linked group shot a man to death this week for being gay. 20-year-old Hashim al-Asimi was reportedly gunned down by members of Ansar al-Sharia, a group on the U.S. terror list. According to Agence France-Presse, the gunman fled the scene on a motorbike shortly after the shooting. Authorities told the Washington Post that it was the 34th such murder of a gay man by Islamic fundamentalists in Yemen in recent years. Friends of the victim told CNN that local militants had ordered him to stop his homosexual activity at least twice and had warned him that he would be killed. But they said that not everyone even knew that al-Asimi was gay. Officials said that residents in the area failed to report the shooting. Security forces discovered the body 2 hours later after a crowd had gathered at the scene. Yemeni law punishes homosexual acts, even between consenting adults in private, with execution.
Back in the U.S., a key witness in the high-profile trial of George Zimmerman told CNN's Piers Morgan this week that Florida teen Trayvon Martin may have thought that Zimmerman was following him with rape in mind. Rachel Jontel said that people need to understand that he didn't want that creep going to his father or girlfriend's house. His little brother was there. She said that Martin had called her to ask for advice after he realized that Zimmerman was following him. The cop wannabe, who's white, was acquitted in the shooting death of the unarmed 17-year-old black teenager, claiming self-defense because he said that Martin had attacked him first. Jontel's comments came a day after 35 American LGBT rights groups, led by the National Black Justice Coalition and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, issued a joint statement calling for a federal Justice Department investigation into the shooting because the groups said Trayvon Martin deserves justice and his civil rights.
In happier LGBT news, Mexico has its first openly gay mayor, and observers are somewhat astonished that it's in what's been called a rough part of Zacatecas state that's better known for cowboy boots and drug gang shootouts than pride parades. 47-year-old singer and gay bar owner Benjamin Medrano was elected mayor on July 7th in Fresnillo, a rural city of about 230,000 people in the northern part of the country. He begins his tenure in September. While some Mexican politicians have been rumored to be gay, none has ever come out. And even though he generally supports LGBT rights, the devoutly Roman Catholic Medrano certainly doesn't have a gay agenda. For example, he doesn't support marriage equality because, he explains, I cannot go against church doctrine. And in Fresnillo, we have strong roots in our religion and in our customs. He says he is, nevertheless, very proud to be the first openly gay mayor in this country and in a township where there are 258 villages full of tough country people who don't necessarily have much information on what's happening elsewhere and have even less of an automatic sympathy with their gay mayor. But, he adds, it's not like I'm going to paint City Hall pink either.
And finally, activists in Okinawa, Japan, inspired by the ever-growing annual gathering in Singapore, did go pink at the first-ever Pink Dot Okinawa LGBT Pride event on July 14th. About 100 participants had been expected, but more than 800 pink-attired people showed up to make a colorful statement in support of LGBT equality. Organizers called it a big breakthrough and historic first step, and say that they plan to hold the second Pink Dot Okinawa next year.
That's News Wrap for the weekend in July 20th, 2013. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced this week by Angela Brooks and Steve Pry.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
Three groundbreaking queer artists are remembered in very different ways on this week's program. We begin with an opportune accolade for a gay literary icon. The acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of black teenager Trayvon Martin has prompted even President Barack Obama to speak openly about the experiences of African-American men. No one has ever done that quite like author and activist James Baldwin, whose Notes of a Native Son has recently been reissued. This Way Out queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason takes a new look at the iconic classic.
James Baldwin is a writer who is worth returning to. His collection of essays, Notes of a Native Son, was reissued by Beacon Press to commemorate the 25th anniversary of his death. Described as a leading American thinker on race, Baldwin was an openly gay black man whose second novel, Giovanni's Room, published in 1956, was a love story between two white men. Giovanni's Room placed Baldwin squarely in the center of the LGBT literary canon. I first read Baldwin shortly after I had come out and had mustered up the courage to enter the country's oldest gay and lesbian bookstore, named after Baldwin's groundbreaking novel. I was raised in a primarily white tract house suburban neighborhood, studied journalism in college, and came out in the early 1980s at the age of 23. I was aware of the politics of class and had come out in an unusually racially diverse community, but still there was much I learned about American racism from James Baldwin. That Baldwin wrote primarily from his perspective as a black man is not surprising considering the hostilities of the time in which he lived. In his essay, Notes of a Native Son, Baldwin, who was born and raised in Harlem and who had moved to New Jersey as a young man, wrote, I learned in New Jersey that to be a Negro meant, precisely, that one was never looked at, but was simply at the mercy of the reflexes the color of one's skin caused in other people. I knew about Jim Crow, but I had never experienced it. I went to the same self-service restaurant 3 times and stood with all the Princeton boys before the counter, waiting for a hamburger and coffee. It was always an extraordinarily long time before anything was set before me. Negroes were not served there, I was told, and they had been waiting for me to realize that I was always the only Negro present. Once I was told this, I was determined to go there all the time, but now they are ready for me, and though some dreadful scenes were subsequently enacted in that restaurant, I never ate there again. As I read about Baldwin's life, I found myself wondering about what was written between the lines. When he talked about his difficult relationship with his preacher father, I wondered how much more difficult this must have been given Baldwin's sexual orientation. In No So Native Son, Baldwin writes that when he was in high school, he was the editor of the high school magazine and he was a young minister, and had been preaching from the pulpit. He writes that his father noticed that he was preaching less often and abruptly said to him, "You'd rather write than preach, wouldn't you?" Baldwin answered yes, and then went on to write that was all we had ever said. For Baldwin, this was a tragic memory and a reminder that he was never close to his father, but it was also a life-changing moment, one in which Baldwin's father just may have prompted his son into making the realization that he was going to be a writer. A great one. Another one of Baldwin's life-changing moments came when he had finished his second novel, Giovanni's Room, and, as he writes, "Publishers Row, that hotbed of perception, looked on the book with horror and loathing, refused to touch it, saying that I was a young Negro writer, who, if he published this book, would alienate his audience and ruin his career. They would not, in short, publish it as a favor to me. I conveyed my gratitude, perhaps a shade too sharply, borrowed money from a friend, and myself and my lover took the boat to France." Baldwin spent many years living and writing abroad. Identity is part of who we are, a birthright. As Baldwin writes, "My birthright was vast, connecting me to all that lives and to everyone forever." This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Jim Hutton remembers Freddie Mercury, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. In 1985, a butch hairdresser named Jim Hutton headed out to a gay club in London called Heaven, and that's what he found. His name was Freddie Mercury, the flamboyant showman. Before long, Jim found himself sharing the superstar's 8-bedroom home with a cook and assistant on staff. In July of 1985, when Freddie electrified Live Aid, Jim watched backstage. "I was gobsmacked," Jim said. You could feel the effect his stage presence had on the crowd. Just 6 short years later, Freddie died of AIDS. In his will, Freddie left Jim £500,000, as well as a plot of land in his native Ireland, where he built a house. When a Queen song would come on the radio, he'd turn it up full blast. Sadly, on New Year's Day 2010, Jim died of cancer just 3 days short of his 61st birthday. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Gene Pembleton.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
He was despised.
That rendition of "He Was Despised" from Handel's Messiah is sung by out countertenor David Daniels. He's starring this month in the Santa Fe Opera's world premiere of a new work based on the last years of the despised gay literary giant Oscar Wilde. Spencer Beckwith from KUNM-FM at the University of New Mexico chats with Daniels about his collaborative effort with composer Theodore Morrison to bring Oscar to life.
David Daniels will be on the stage at the Santa Fe Opera. The great American countertenor has been in Santa Fe before, in 2008 in Handel's Radamisto, and 2 years ago in Vivaldi's Griselda. But this year, David Daniels is not appearing in a work from the Baroque period, rather in a new opera, and in a role written especially for him, Oscar Wilde, in the world premiere of Theodore Morrison's Oscar. And David Daniels is seated with us outside in the opera's cantina. David, it's wonderful to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
you and composer Theodore Morrison go back quite a few years.
Yeah, you can call him Theo. It's okay.
Okay, Theo. You were a student of his.
I was
Michigan.
In his choir at University of Michigan from 1990 to 92 during graduate school at University of Michigan. So I've known him for quite a few years.
But we don't all stay in touch with people who we study with in school. There must have been a strong connection between the two of you.
Well, we had sung some of his compositions in choir. And when I became a countertenor in 1992 at Michigan, he wanted to write a song cycle for me. And he did so, called Chamber Music, five poems of James Joyce, and performed them all over the world. And it was in London where I performed them that John Cox heard them, who is our librettist.
Right.
And John came back and just loved them and said, Theo, do you want to write an opera? And that's how it started.
And you had some very specific ideas about what you wanted that opera to be.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know exactly what I wanted subject-wise, but what I did know is that I wanted it to be relevant today. I wanted it to be an issue that was dear to me, that was important, and that could translate in 2013 or whenever we were going to get it produced. And John and Theo came up with Oscar. It was not me. I jumped on the wagon, you know, as soon as I heard.
You did. Was it an immediate reaction?
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah. Why, David?
Because I'm a gay man, and I never have gotten to play a gay man on the stage. And until I've gotten into rehearsals here, I never knew how emotional it was going to be. And it's been really tough.
Tell me about that. In what way?
I'm used to being in love with Cleopatra or Popeye, or and so this is brand new territory for me, and I'm able to more so than usual bring my own life into it. And you surround yourself with a cast that we have here, and Bozy, my significant other, who's just a wonderful dancer, Reed Luplat.
And Bozy is a dancer.
Bozy is a dancer. Oscar really didn't see Bozy much once the charges were brought up on him until he was out of prison. But he is in this, and he appears all the way through the opera in my imagination. And
that's a great, very theatrical idea.
Yeah, but it's just been the energy of the young artists and everybody just are so passionate about this that it's a unique experience.
One of your unique talents, in my opinion, is the ability to make very extravagant characters feel very believable, very human.
Oh, thank you.
And obviously, Oscar Wilde is a very extravagant character.
Yeah.
What have you chosen to emphasize about him?
I think I've always thought, and I think even going into opening night, this is not about me portraying Oscar Wilde's character, doing an imitation of Oscar sitting, you know, with his cigarette and striking poses. Even physically, I don't think it's necessary for me to look exactly like the pictures of Oscar Wilde. And I certainly am not going to sing and bring this character to life, you know, trying to be sort of like a mimic of Oscar Wilde. This is about getting into the story and of the human emotion of this character and this relationship and the horribleness that happened to him at Reading Jail.
What kind of input did you have, David? I know you've been involved with it since the very beginning. Did John Cox and Theodore Morrison ask for your input?
Musically, I had a lot of influence with Theo. When he first started this opera, I was still living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I got to see him a lot when I was not singing. And he, you know, I was able to talk about where the vocal line sits, what's good, what's not, what vowels are good. So that part, drama-wise, the only thing I ever said was that I want it to be as simple and real and not a melodrama. I want this to be about the hurt and the love that this man.
You said that you wanted this to be relevant. I don't think anybody could have foreseen quite how relevant this has become in the summer of 2013.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty amazing.
We open, what, a month to the day that DOMA and Prop 8 were struck down? It's just, it's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, great publicity, but the human part of that story is more important.
And I'm sure that's a part of your emotional process in working on it.
It is. It is, absolutely.
David Daniels is Oscar Wilde in Theodore Morrison's new opera, Oscar, through August 17th at the Santa Fe Opera. For This Way Out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm Spencer Beckwith.
For the straight folks who don't mind gays, but wish they weren't so blatant.
The late, lamented lesbian poet Pat Parker.
You know, some people got a lot of nerve. Sometimes I don't believe the things I see and hear. Have you met the woman who's shocked by two women kissing and in the same breath tells you that she's pregnant? But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or this straight couple sits next to you in a movie and you can't hear the dialogue because of the sound effects. But gays shouldn't be blatant. And the woman in your office spends your whole lunch hour talking about her new bikini drawers and how much her husband likes them. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or the hip chick in your class rattling a mile a minute while you're trying to get stoned in a john about the camping trip she took with her musician boyfriend. But gays shouldn't be blatant. You go in a public bathroom, and all over the walls, there's John loves Mary, Janice digs Richard, Pepe loves Dolores, etc. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or you go to an amusement park, and there's a tunnel of love, and pictures of straights painted on the front, and grinning couples coming in and out. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Fact is, blatant heterosexuals are all over the place. Supermarkets, movies, at work, in church, in books, on television, every day and night, every place, even in gay bars. And they want gay men and women to go hide in the closets. So to you straight folks, I say, sure, I'll go, if you go too, but I'm polite, so after you. Thank you.
That was pioneering lesbian feminist poet and activist Pat Parker. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Pam Marshall, Michael LeBeau, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Gene Pemberton, Stephen Fry, and Spencer Beckwith contributed program material. Thanks also to Angela Brooks and Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is funded by the Ivana Foundation, the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and our loyal listener supporters. Check out the ways we say thank you at thiswayout.org, where you'll also find news wrap in text form and links to our podcast, blog, Facebook page, and more. You can also hear This Way Out on iTunes. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUR, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, 4CCR, Cairns, Queensland, WOJB, Hayward, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned!